This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Everybody, this is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8:55 p.m. to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our website on thepeoplespeakradio.com. There you can also hear live shows or listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. The People Speak is a live one-hour radio show that reaches people all over the U.S., Canada, and Australia, and even as far away as the United Kingdom. Our audience can call in by phone and speak to me or our guest by dialing 1-415-762-1162 or 1-712-432-0075 and entering access code 318116 with the pound sign after it. We're also excited to announce that you can listen to us now on your smartphone, so there's no excuse to hear the world's most fascinating people right here on the People Speak Radio. We have a wonderful guest with us this evening. And I'm very proud to have Wes Tunnell from Dr. Tunnell is a gentleman, and I just lost your bio, Wes, so I'm going to let you. I apologize with all my heart. I had it here a minute ago, and such is the way of computers, but I will allow you to talk about yourself, Wes. Wes, you're a professor of?
Yes, biology or marine biology at Texas A&M University in Corpus Christi, Texas. I'm with the Hart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies, a research institute that focuses on studies of the Gulf of Mexico, as the title implies.
As the title implies, and the Gulf of Mexico is unfortunately the reason that we're here talking tonight. There's a lot going on down there, Wes. What is it? What's happening? And please, could you fill us in a little bit on the situation itself, how it started, first of all?
Okay, sure. Well, the Deepwater Horizon platform, which is a very, very large drilling rig, one of those interesting ones that's not tethered to the bottom. It wasn't on pilings or anchored to the bottom. It was actually one of these large devices that actually stays in place by what's called dynamic positioning. So it's kind of this floating city out there that is held in place by big motors and thrusters and connections to the satellite. And so it was out there drilling and just finished drilling a well and was starting to decouple from that. The platform itself was owned by Transocean, and the company that owns the well that was doing the drilling, of course, is BP, or formerly known as British Petroleum. Mm-hmm. And through complications on the 20th of April, the well blew out, and the rig caught on fire and burned for a number of hours before it toppled and sank. And unfortunately, of the 126 people that were on board, 11 men are still missing, and by now presumed that they will not be found. The rest of those were able to be evacuated to the land. The unique thing that's different about this one is it is the first one of these blowouts to take place in very deep water. So this one's in about 5,000 feet of water, almost a mile deep. And so that really complicates the issues.
Well, so not only not only is it is the what's happening at the level of the bottom of the ocean about a mile deep, but isn't the actual well and the pipeline itself another 1,800 feet beneath the surface?
Well, 18,000 feet.
18,000. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yes. Yes. The depth of the well that went for the total amount of distance to the bottom of where it was drilled in the earth below the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And so the failures that took place for this to happen are pretty unprecedented. I only know of one other blowout preventer, the device that's supposed to stop this. One other of these happening, I'm not an expert in that field, but the other one happened in 1979. And it was in the Gulf of Mexico also, in the southern Gulf, called the Ixtoc spill, and it was owned by Pemex, the Mexican National Drilling and Oil Company there. And it was actually, and still is, the largest oil spill in the world by history, at least the largest peacetime oil spill. The Gulf War oil spill over there was much, much larger, but as far as peacetime spills, the Ixtoc spill was the largest. And so this one that just blew out is another of these unprecedented failures. And the reason I say unprecedented is for your listeners to understand that there's been about 7,000 of these platforms in the northwestern Gulf of Mexico over the last 50 years or so. When they're finished, they're taken out and taken to land and dismantled, or they're made as artificial reefs in a few places. And there's currently a little over 3,500 of these platforms out there. And each platform may have 10 to 20, sometimes as many as 30 wells drilled on it. So we're talking 20, 25,000 wells that have been drilled in the area. And so to have only one of these blowout preventers go out is why I'm saying unprecedented.
And may I... Now, obviously, outside of the loss of life, we are looking at probably, and I'm hearing a lot of stories since I've talked to you, Wes, yesterday, and a lot of different versions, and I'm hearing that this is getting worse and than they ever even thought it was going to get. Worse how?
Yes, by the volume of oil that was being released in the early days, they were thinking it was only about 1,000 barrels a day, and then it was increased last week to about 5,000 barrels a day. And that's kind of hard for us to comprehend in numbers. The total amount that's been released now is in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 million gallons of oil. And to put that in perspective with the Ixtoc spill that I mentioned a while ago, the largest in history, that total was 140 million gallons because it blew for 9 months before they were able to put it out. So we're only at a fraction right now of what's taking place. But if you're in that area where the spill is likely to reach shore and is starting to reach shore, then it's a huge concern. And our concern is how long it might go. If it's slowed down or stopped in the next weeks or months, it'll certainly be much better than if it goes for more months down the road. We heard some good news just towards the end of the day today that the flow had actually slowed down some.
Do they know what would have caused it to slow down that way? Hello? Hello?
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to EarthShare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and wiki spaces where you can share and collaborate? Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution, if you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economists on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's the People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for the broken.
Hello, folks. That's live radio for you. Welcome back, and this is Basma Farhad of the People's Radio with Dr. Wes Tunnell, a broadly trained marine biologist, ecologist, and with a particular interest in the field studies on coral reefs and coastal areas of the Gulf of Mexico, which has unfortunately been the place where all of these incredible events are taking place. Events such as oil leaking into the Gulf and reaching areas that we don't know. It's looking pretty big, Wes, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is, and time will tell how much longer it'll go and what kind of impact we'll have. It looks like the major threat, of course, right now is kind of that eastern side of the Mississippi Delta, and the mm-hmm. northern coast there of Mississippi and Alabama, maybe western Florida.
Now, let me ask you, Wes. Obviously, the questions are yet to be answered, and everything that we can see so far has been nothing more than placing blame on somebody else. What we're looking at here is probably one of the most devastating events that has ever happened in the Gulf. How is this going to affect the Gulf, the coastal areas? How is this going to affect marine life? How is this going to affect the coral reefs, if any, in that area? Can you help us to assess in our own minds what's going to be happening there?
Sure, sure. It's a matter of perspective that we have to come from and to look kind of at history and what's happened in the past, put together what we think might happen. And, of course, a big thing that we don't know is how much oil and how much time it's going to be spewing out into the Gulf, and that's going to have very large relevance on what impact it is in the long run. But, for instance, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration uses this scale called the Environmental Sensitivity Index, and it's on a scale of 1 to 10, how areas are impacted from light to very devastating, and that's on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the least impacted and 10 being the most impacted. And unfortunately, the Mississippi Delta area and the salt marshes are number 10 on that list, meaning
wow.
that they can be impacted heavily, and then it takes a long time for them to recover. However,
mm-hmm.
If we look at history, the Eekstok oil spill that we mentioned earlier that spewed into the Gulf for 9 months and was 140 million gallons total, the largest spill in history, you'd be hard-pressed to find any evidence of that today. In fact, in 3 to 5 years after that spill, it was hard to see any impacts from that. And part of the reason for this kind of resilience of the Gulf of Mexico, and it may be one of the most resilient bodies of water in the world, is that we have natural seepage there that takes place all the time. It's been estimated by the experts that we leak something like 1 to 2 supertankers in size in the Gulf of Mexico every year.
Really, that much?
I
know that there has been talk of that, but I didn't realize it was that heavily impacted.
Yes, well, it's a huge amount, and the good side of what that does is that it makes the waters and the shoreline sediments and areas able to take care of oil spills naturally, because they're doing it all the time naturally anyway. And what takes place are microorganisms or bacteria that live in the water surface or on the shoreline are able to actually eat and break down the oil. And so that's a good thing for us in the Gulf of Mexico, because it is doing that process naturally all the time. That's
mm-hmm.
not to say that there's not going to be some pretty bad impacts from this, and we'll have to deal with those and the cleanup of them. But we do have that part that we can look to maybe 3 years or so down the road to those areas that are impacted. Can be recovered or recovering, but it will vary. Sandy beaches may recover within a year. Salt marshes may not cover for 8 to 10 years, so it really is variable.
But let me ask you, at the same time, although the Mother Earth tends to be very resilient, our fishing industry and our industries based in those areas are not necessarily as resilient. Can we sustain an impact like this on our economic situation down there?
Well, you're right about looking at the economics of the fisheries. Louisiana is the most productive state as far as our finfish and shellfish go. Large amounts of seafood, for instance, we might say somewhere around 80% of the seafood production from the Gulf of Mexico comes from Louisiana coastal wetlands, and 40% of the wetlands of the United States, the lower 48 anyway, are in Louisiana. So Louisiana is huge in that sense. And so the economics of that can be impacted depending upon how much that oil kills the salt marshes that are there, which are kind of the nursery grounds for all of the marine and estuarine species that live in the area. It's been estimated that about 90% of the recreational and commercial fisheries that people that go fishing go out and catch those species are tied to the estuaries in one part of their life cycle. And so damaging those very sensitive wetlands can be catastrophic to the particular area where it hits. The concern that I have is that the oil as it goes in may just land in a band of, say, 50 yards in width or so along the marshes mm-hmm. of the Louisiana mm-hmm. Delta. And the difficult thing is we can't go in and clean those up. We have found from past spills that cleaning up a marsh is actually worse than the spill itself, because heavy equipment and people walking in the marsh push the oil deeper into the sediments, and then it lasts even longer.
Oh, so wow, yeah, that's something I guess people never thought about.
Right. And so if we just sacrifice a band of oil, 50 yards wide or something like that, is one thing. But as we come into the tropical storm season of the summer, say in July and August, the oil still would float on water. And so if we had a storm surge that lifted up that oil from the beach where it was, it could carry it further into the marsh. And those marshes are the productive areas that we were just talking about. And they're also protective areas for instance, like New Orleans from hurricanes. We know that about a mile of marsh can dampen a foot or so of storm surge as it comes in. So those marshes are protective to the coastline also.
Well, this is another, and since you brought up the topic of the hurricanes, I have a series of questions from guests calling from all over the country and out of the country. And so we may as well start, because everybody is really hoping to get some answers here, Wes. Scott in Missouri asked just this question: will the oil slick cause the water temperature to rise fast, causing stronger hurricanes in the Gulf this year?
No, I don't think that would be the case. The oil might, as it got into shallow waters, increase the temperature, but in the body of water, the large volume of the Gulf, I don't think that'll take place.
Well, that's at least a blessing, because obviously somebody out there is worried about this. Rob from Canada asks, Wes, are you aware of any substances that can be used to congeal and partially solidify crude oil, thus making cleanup somewhat easier?
There are products along the lines of what we were just talking of in the natural sense, the bioremediation, we call it, when bacteria actually feed upon the petroleum product to break it down. There are companies that have literally packaged, so to speak, raised and packaged microorganisms that can be placed on an oil spill to help degrade it faster, even adding nutrients to help that process go on. And so that's one process that does speed up that process. Another is that in the natural sense, evaporation is taking place as soon as the oil hits the surface coming up from the bottom. And as it drifts in the water, it's evaporating. And then there's kind of a photochemical process also that is breaking down the oil. And so all of those are taking off the lighter fractions, we call it, the part that you can smell, the aromatic parts of it, as that evaporates, and that makes the oil more solidified or more tar-like. But it stays mm-hmm. light when it's doing that, so it stays on the surface, and that's a good thing. We don't want it to go on the bottom and get in the sediments or the habitats that are on the bottom. Staying on the surface
right.
is good.
And, you know, how concerning is this, is the fact that they're planning on, or at least they expect to try at least, burning some of the oil off.
That has been a successful only right around the area where the oil first reaches the surface, because the volatile components are still there, and so they put these big booms, or a boom is just a floating fence, so they corral the oil as it comes up and then light it and let it burn in place. And so burning it off takes it off the surface. Of course, it puts the soot and stuff in the air, but it takes it off the surface. I've had experience with burning the oil in a salt marsh before, and it was actually a good technique for cleaning up a pipeline spill along the Texas coast. But in our case, there had been rainfall, so the oil floated on top of the 3 or 4 inches of rainfall and burned off, and the water was like insulation to the marsh, and so the marsh was able to recover from that. However, the oil that we have now that's evaporating 50 miles offshore, as it drifts into the coastline, by the time it gets into the coastline, it's not going to be volatile enough to catch on fire. They would actually have to dump some kind of volatile material on it to get it to burn.
Mm, fascinating. I mean, there's so many different ways to look at this. And here's one that's really has a lot of people panicked. And thank you, Chris, in New York, for bringing this up. And Chris in New York says, someone mentioned using a nuke to seal the rig leak. What problems would arise from that solution?
I heard someone last week mention that. I think that we'd be in much more problems if we did something like that. I think that's too much of an unknown. We might blow a hole in the bottom and allow a lot more to escape than is escaping now. The northern part of the Gulf of Mexico is literally just covered underground with oil and gas. It looks like a series of underwater mountains on the continental slope out there, many pushed up by the salt domes that are underneath the continental shelf, and there are pockets of oil and gas all out in there. So we wouldn't want to disturb things like that.
I certainly thought it was a pretty crazy idea myself, but some people were actually discussing the issue as if it was a feasible subject. I'm thinking to myself, I don't think any of the people that I heard discussing it knew anything about nuclear power. and I don't know much about nuclear power. Well, let me say something, and I'm going to put this in such a way and I think a lot of people are going to be in my position. Obviously, you are the expert, and that's why you're here, to answer the questions that we feel are. But even when you talked just now about the burning off of surface oil at the point that the water was coming out, the oil was coming out from the water. For me, Wes, what that sounds like is, okay, if I start a fire at the top of an oil leak, isn't that going to just kind of go down? Even though there is water, isn't the potential for an explosion there when you're dealing with fire? I'm sure that whoever's burning it off probably knows pretty well what they're doing, but it just seems like such a risky area. And as you said, the entirety of that area, and from my understanding, it's got one of the largest oil reserves, certainly untapped, but one of the largest oil reserves on the planet underneath the Gulf. That sounds like awfully dangerous stuff.
Well, in actuality, though, the fire doesn't go down very deep, and it's because of the pressure of the water. The gas bubbles that are coming up from the bottom, the methane, usually burn better than the oil a little ways down in the water. But because of the pressure of the water, it doesn't allow that fire to go very deep. And I don't know how deep, but it's probably not more than 10 or 20 feet in depth that fire would go, and maybe not even that deep.
It still sounds like some pretty scary stuff may develop with this. We have another question from Mike in California, and Mike asked, does Dr. Tunnel feel accountability No, that's interesting. For oil rig explosion, for the oil rig explosion extends beyond the British Petroleum, Halliburton, and on towards the administration and the U.S. policies on using oil rigs, which are a dangerous accident waiting to happen in the first place. That was a big mouthful. I'm not sure, Mike, what you're trying to ask when you say, does Dr. Tunnell feel accountability? I don't see where Dr. Tunnell would have anything to do with this unless you own a big portion of Halliburton, Wes.
Yeah. Well,
maybe we could blame you. But I'm sure there's going to be plenty of blame to be had, Wes, but I think that there are some accountability issues that really
have to
be looked at.
Yes, and I think some people may blame Texans, for instance, or Louisianans, because that's where all of this is taking place. And so that's an interesting point of maybe looking at the culture of what took place here almost 100 years ago when Texas and Louisiana decided that they were going to be an oil and gas exploration states and production. And so that's part of our culture and our nature here. I'm not endorsing it one way or the other, and there are people or organizations that are to blame when accidents happen like this, and BP has taken responsibility. Many people will think, well, it shouldn't have ever happened in the first place, but we're kind of wandering off into areas that are not my expertise, but we're all still driving cars, and we're kind of forcing the issue with we'd like to have our own oil and gas taken from the U.S. rather than buying it from overseas. And so that takes up the fact that we've drilled most of the terrestrial or land areas and the continental shelf, and so the greater quantities of oil are now in deeper water, and so it's just kind of pushing the oil industry in those areas. Should mm-hmm. we look at what's happened now? For sure. Should we shut everything down because of this accident? I certainly don't think we should. So there's obviously lots of opinion and thoughts both ways that could go on that.
Well, obviously, we have. I think in the days and months to come, we're going to have. And unfortunately, for the people involved, I do believe, Wes, that we have to have major accountability in these areas. Because no matter what we say, I think eventually even Mother Nature will start to not respond as kindly to us dumping everything into her in the wrong way. I think the oil was there to begin with, and we all know that, but the earth accommodates for it in a different way, certainly not with us poking and prodding. So I think that if we're going to do it, I think we have to have our accountability measures and transparency in place so that we know when something like this happens, we don't have to start shifting blame, that we can actually say, this was the problem, we should have addressed this. But I think, you know, obviously addressing it long before any of these events is probably an important thing. We do have a couple more questions before. I don't want to lose any of our listeners here. John from Canada asked, now this is an interesting one. Now I know nothing about this, Wes, so I'm going to leave this one. Why not use a sports stadium roof material to create a condom-catheter and pump oil to surface collection?
Well, that's a very good thought, and that's exactly what they tried that actually failed in the last couple of days, this four-story dome that they put on top of the well. Unfortunately, it didn't work, and they're now regrouping and making a smaller one. The reason the one didn't work 2 days ago was the fact that gas hydrates, which is kind of a new term to us in the last 20 years, are these frozen methane crystals that are down in the bottom, and it filled up that dome with kind of like a snow cone slushy of ice fragments, and so it just plugged it up, and it wouldn't work. And so the new one they're devising is smaller in size, but it will have hot water circulating through it to keep that ice crystals from plugging it up. And they'll try to do exactly what he's saying here, is to drop it over the top of where the oil is coming out of the bottom, and it'll be connected to a long hose that comes up to a ship or a barge on the top to try to collect that. In fact, that was a successful, sort of successful device that was used during the Eekstock spill 30 years ago. They called it then the sombrero, and it was something like a sombrero hat or an upside-down funnel with a hose on the top, and it's been used in some other places in the world in blowouts also. But the others have been in 100 to 200 feet of water, and this 5,000 feet of water is really the challenge.
It's deeper than we've ever attempted anything like this before, I know that.
Yes.
Scott from Missouri, Scott is a character, I think. Scott, it's very interesting the way you put that. Scott in Missouri is back, and he has another follow-up question. He says, I've heard of everything from blocking the leak with rubber tires, golf balls, hair, and pantyhose. Dropping a haystack to soak up the oil to nuking the well. What does the professor believe is the quickest, most efficient way to stop the leak? Now, there's a question for you. We have a professor here that's, why didn't we just ask you that in the first place?
Well, I'm just a lowly biologist. I'm not an engineer or technician for doing those sorts of inventive things. I think that they've got some of the brightest minds around that are trying to work on fixing this, and some of these things sound really strange to us, like these upside-down funnels and putting golf balls and pieces of rubber and those kind of things into it. But, you know, whatever works is what they're going to do. They're going to keep trying until they figure something out. If it doesn't work with these temporary stops, the next stop will be drilling the other well. The unfortunate thing about that is it's drilled off to the side and then slanted into the same area, and then they would pump in the mud to stop the flow of this well. That takes about 90 days. It started about 10 days ago, so we're still a ways away from that. Not surefire fix, but a pretty certain fix. We're hoping that they can.
It seems like forever ago that we've been hearing about this spill, and it's only been 10 days. Unbelievable. Sharon from Louisiana asks an interesting question here, Wes. Can an ecologist with a good conscience in any way justify or advocate oil rig drilling?
Yes. It's been going on for 50 or 60 years. To put this in perspective in a monetary sense, second in the United States only to the income tax are the oil and gas royalties that come out of the Gulf of Mexico. So they're number two on the list of generating funding for running the United States. So that's an economic side. If we look at what's taken place out there now, and I can tell you from a personal sense that early in my career in the 70s and 80s, I was fighting the oil companies right and left to try to clean up their act, following on to all of the new environmental laws that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. And I can tell you that I've seen a change in the 1990s in many of the oil companies, some of the larger ones. They're not perfect, they're not clean all the way, but I've seen more of a stewardship mindset to where they approach things differently in many ways. I had the good fortune to study the Flower Gardens National Marine Sanctuary off of Galveston, about 100 miles offshore. It's the most northerly coral reef in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice coral reef sitting on top of a underwater mountain. And as we were doing our monitoring out there for a week at a time, at nighttime, I could look out around the ship and I could count 12 or 15 oil and gas platforms in the distance. And so these have been operating there for decades safely, bringing in oil and gas. And so if the right regulations are in place, we can do this. Whenever we have one of these accidents, it gives everybody a black eye, and we need to stop and try to figure out how we can fix that situation. But we can't stop everything with the demand that we see now. If we all want to go to riding bicycles, which may not be a bad idea, we could change that part of our culture.
Well, unfortunately, we do like our stuff, and I think a lot of people, even myself as an advocate of ecological ethicity, I find that it'd be a really hard life if we just stopped doing what we always say that we should stop doing. And
yes,
I don't
yes.
know that people ever really think about these the implications of, just stop drilling and just stop doing this and just stop doing that. But are we really ready to give up all of the comforts that we have in our lives that these things have given us? Oil has given us a lot of comfort in our lives, and it makes our lives much easier. And just to say, let's just stop doing this. Now, I have to tell you, on the other hand, I do have to say that I feel that considering this is the deepest we've ever drilled, I can't understand why this administration or leading in from a previous administration, it doesn't matter who it was, but somebody out there got a pass on efficiency, and as far as like the, I think it was called the, let me see, what was that called? The Mineral Management Services gave waivers to the final approval of this rig. And if that is the truth, now that I find unacceptable. If we're going to be digging risking enormous, I mean, just the risk, as I said, if we didn't even care about the ecology, because, you know, we've heard it all recently based on what's happening in the climate and whether we are part of our climate or part of our world or not. But even if we didn't care about that, if we only cared about the monetary situation, the leak is going to cause unfathomable havoc and devastation to many industries in the Gulf area. So even if it was just the monetary situation, I think that it behooves us that we need to make sure that nobody ever slips by again. No rig owner, operator, renter, insurance company that insures them ever gets a free pass on these things, that you cannot allow these things to. And that's what they think is happening right now. They believe that Halliburton was given a pass and waivers to on the inspections, and that's why some of these things went unnoticed. Another part of the problem is that this is just the way things have always been done, and everybody assumes that the contracts are workable at this depth, which I don't think they are. Are they, Wes? Are the same parameters, are the same expectations good for a depth of a mile down as they were at 150 feet?
No. Apparently we've found out in a very sad way that conditions aren't the same. The companies have been slowly approaching this and slowly mm-hmm. moving out in deep water. They didn't just go from the edge of the continental shelf at 400 or 500 feet to this 5,000 feet. They've been slowly getting deeper and deeper over the last decade. But we obviously have lots to learn, not only about the process, but about taking care when something takes place like this. And so it's a difficult situation. Part of this new institute where I am that was founded by and funded by the philanthropist Mr. Ed Hart gave the money to start this new institute so that we could work together for having kind of a healthy economy and a healthy ecology or healthy ecosystem. And so using science to support the sustainable use and conservation of the Gulf of Mexico is our mission at this institute. And so those kind of things don't happen overnight, but we're starting to make a difference with working with other people and looking at the total aspect of not just the ecology or just the economy, but trying to be sure they work together.
Well, I just, hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It seems like my phone connection is just gone up a notch. I feel like I'm talking to myself. Ultimately, what ends up happening is that the government will take blame for this, will it not, Wes? Is that how it's kind of looking?
Yes, probably so. There'll be, as you pointed out earlier, a lot of finger-pointing in all directions. The regulators will say they did their part, and the companies will say they did their part, so it'll be a long investigation that'll take place. But hopefully all of us can benefit from the process, and the end point is that they find out what the problem is and make the decision whether to keep doing this or not. Maybe they'll just back off and say we shouldn't be doing it in deep water like that. We'll just have to wait and see what time holds.
Well, from my understanding, they're not really stopping any of the drilling at all, just kind of not talking about it right now. I know they're not talking about it in town halls at this point. Let me ask you, what is your biggest concern as a marine biologist and ecologist? What are you most concerned about?
Well, I think a good point to consider is maybe what one of the callers asked a while ago, and talking about this kind of accountability and putting us all in the same boat. Many people are familiar with Rachel Carson's book of Silent Spring in the 1960s and what a huge impact it had on mainly the land and the freshwater. Mm-hmm. And we had lots of laws then passed towards the end of the 60s and early 70s, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and a lot of things started getting better. The 60s were really getting bad, and then things started getting better in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
In the ocean, however, we started seeing things getting worse in certain places, and then now we've seen some things like overfishing that are worldwide, not just in certain places or certain regions. And Sylvia Earle, who is the famous oceanographer at the National Geographic Society, their explorer in residence, she's the chair of our advisory council for the Hart Institute, and she did a book called Sea Change. And I think it's it points out, kind of like Rachel Carson's book did in the 60s, the Sea Change book by Sylvia has to do with the oceans. We're kind of reaching a tipping point in the oceans in certain areas where things are getting so bad that we just must fix them as soon as we can. And fortunately, the Pew Oceans Commission and the U.S. Ocean Commission addressed these things in the last several years. President Obama is now working with a national ocean policy that'll direct work on our coasts and oceans. And so there's some things taking place now to look at the coasts and oceans in a total or a holistic way. This new thing called marine spatial planning that we never heard of a few years ago is to start looking at the oceans like we've looked at the land and taking care of zones for doing things. And so we're at a critical tipping point in the oceans now, and we really need to take special care of them. So to look back on the spill now, it's like, oh, we just tripped and fell. So it's something we really have to work with to try to get back to the point of the synergy that we had going on taking care of the oceans and coast in the last several years.
Well, briefly, can you tell me, when you talk about a tipping point, what are the things that are tipping this that you think are avoidable?
Well, if we look in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, most of your listeners have probably heard of the dead zone off the mouth of the Mississippi River. That's been there for a couple of decades now, and it kind of goes up and down in size, but it's about 10,000 square miles, 5 to 10,000 depending upon the time of year. And a lot of that comes from agricultural fertilizers and chemicals that are placed on farmland in the heartland of the United States and then all come down the watersheds of the Mississippi River and cause algae blooms out in the Gulf. And those fall to the bottom, and the bacteria feed on those, and then it makes it anoxic or hypoxic, meaning low oxygen. And so many organisms can't live there, and we develop this dead zone. And so runoff has become a huge issue, whereas in the earlier years of the 60s and 70s, it was what we call point source discharges at the end of a pipe. New regulations at that time took care of those. But now it's the runoff from our land that's been unregulated that's causing lots of problems. So that's one example of a major issue. Overfishing is another one that maybe some people, some marine scientists, think the biggest issue in the world right now is overfishing and bad fishing techniques. Mm. And so there's a long, long list of these things
just
that
like
are causing
bad
the problem.
Planting techniques. Well, I do declare, Doctor, are you telling us that we actually have something to do with our own environment?
Yes, ma'am, we certainly do. And we all have to be a part of fixing it.
Well, it's nice to hear somebody from the community of scientists that actually believes, as I just said, that we are actually part of our own condition here on Earth. I find it disturbing, to say the least, Doctor, when I hear people say that man has nothing to do with what's happening on the Earth. I'm just so overwhelmed by that statement. And
yeah.
I said, obviously you've never run into a physics professor, have you?
Or looked out the window of an airplane and seen what's happening below.
Exactly. And if yet, how can they get away with saying all that, Wes? I don't understand. I seriously don't.
Well, that's part of, I guess, the beauty of our country. We are able to say things on either side of the spectrum, but hopefully we can come together and work some of these things out.
Well, I sure hope so. It's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I think that you have at least help us to understand what's happening, the severity of the situation down in the Gulf. I personally am just blown away as soon as I heard what was happening. And briefly, I'd like to say this isn't actually a spill. This is a leak. So a spill somehow allows people to think that there's this finiteness that is attached to it. That it was spilled over and it'll end and that's it. This is potentially something that who knows when or if it could ever end unless we stop it.
The blowout is the correct term for it.
Yeah.
And
it's just like amazing. And I have to tell you, I was pretty blown away. I was pretty stunned when I first heard. I knew immediately what we were facing just out of common sense. And I am keeping our fingers crossed here for all of our listeners. And for those of you that are inclined, you can send a lot of energy that way because they sure need it right now to figure all of this out. And as far as accountability, I think accountability is the biggest thing. I want to thank you, Wes Tunnell, Dr. Tunnell, PhD in biology of Texas A&M and Heart Research Institute of the Gulf of Mexico Studies. It has been a pleasure having you on tonight. Thank you. And, you know, Wes, we may call back and call you back soon, depending on how this thing pans out.
Okay, we can just do an update down the road. Hopefully it'll be a good update.
I sure hope so, Wes. Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And here we go, another night. Let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall by the relief of death, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. made for you and me.